Welcome. Welcome and good afternoon. A couple of preliminary announcements of the usual sort. If you have a cell phone or other noise-making device, I would, on this occasion, be personally grateful if you would turn it off. Secondly, there are a couple of seats left here, and then the staff will direct people. We have a sort of remote feed place for those that come in late. It's actually better than this place because you see it on television, you can sneak out and I can't see you. So, but here you are, and here I am, and here we all are. The Athenaeum and the history of libraries today. So I start with a couple of quotations just to set a high tone. The first from Goethe, "Libraries serve as the memories of mankind," which I find inspiring. From Borges, "The universe was called by some the library," which I find Borgesian. And then a couple of factoids. ALA, the American Library Association, counts 120,000 libraries, quote, of all kinds in the United States. And Google reports 350,000 worldwide. I am convinced that number is low, but it's the best I could do. It could be argued that today's talk ought to begin with the acquisition of, or the discovery of, or the evolution of human speech. Because without speech, no writing, without writing, no books or manuscripts, without books or manuscripts, no libraries. But we can't begin with the acquisition of human speech because it's a subject about which nobody knows anything. An anthropologist friend of mine said, if you ask 10 linguists about the origin of human speech, you will get 10 absolutely different answers, which means that at least 9 are wrong, and almost certainly all 10. But we can begin with writing, about which we know a great deal. So we should briefly take a look at that. The current consensus is that writing was independently invented in either 3 or 4 places in the ancient world. Incontestably, the earliest writing that has at least so far been discovered is in Mesopotamia. And it's interesting that this particular form of writing seems to have been invented for the rather unglamorous task of keeping track of jugs of wine and bales of wool. Egypt is the contested 4th place of invention. There's still a lot of dispute about whether they borrowed something or other from Mesopotamia. China is the uncontested 2nd place. And here's a slide of Maya glyphs. The 3rd place, Mesoamerica, a little bit later. It's interesting to me, and has been for some time, that libraries began to appear not too many hundred years after writing began to appear, at least as far as the records indicate. And this slide, which may not look like much to you, doesn't look like a library, is or was apparently a library. The excavation uncovered, as the slide says, you may not be able to see the text, but I'll just summarize it, 20,000 clay tablets, which before the whole thing collapsed, were arranged neatly on wooden shelves. About 2500 BCE, so over 4,000 years ago, first library. The next one I show, just because it's almost impossible to talk about the history of libraries without saluting the library at Alexandria. This slide is called, very carefully and scrupulously, a hypothetical reconstruction because nobody has the faintest idea what the Library of Alexandria looked like. But it has become iconic, legendary, and almost a touchstone for the idea of a library as a comprehensive gathering place for materials of all sort that people, scholars, and perhaps even others can consult. This is a reconstruction based more on archaeological evidence and therefore has some plausibility. A Roman library circa 100 CE. A couple of comments about this. What you can see from the slide is that there are scrolls, obviously, not books, that are arranged on shelves around this building. In order to keep track of what they were reading, what you can't see on the slide is that each scroll had a string attached to it with a label attached to that string, which identified the particular scroll that you were looking for. The other thing to say about this is that several histories of libraries, and there are many histories of libraries, and I strongly recommend them because there is almost nothing more exciting and page-turning than the history of libraries. Several of those histories throw the term around public library for libraries in Rome in the first to second century CE. That seems to me to be about 35% right and 65% rubbish. There were public libraries if you weren't a slave, a plebeian, a child, a woman, or a working person. So they were public in the sense that they weren't single-owned by some rich politician or other powerful figure, but they were hardly, quote, open to the public, a subject to which I will return. This remarkable place, and I will apologize in advance for butchering the Arabic, Al-Karawiyyin Library in Morocco, is widely regarded as the world's oldest continuously operating library, dating back to 859 Common Era, and still in business. Many of you have probably been in places, particularly in England, in some of the old colleges where you will find chained libraries, that is to say, books literally chained to the shelves. As you can see, this was, of course, a device intended to prevent theft. I have shared this slide with some contemporary librarians who, as they sadly watch some of their materials walk out the door, wonder if this might not be an invention whose time has come again. Now we come closer. This is a man who needs no introduction, therefore no caption, at least not in Philadelphia. Benjamin Franklin, 1731. This painting is not 1731. I'm asking you to cast yourself back to 1731 and into the companionship of Benjamin Franklin. At this time, 1731, this is a guy story, by the way. So you are a man living in this part of Philadelphia, which in 1731 was about all the Philadelphia there was. The whole population of the city was probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 19 to 20,000. You're a relatively prosperous man. You're a merchant or a banker or a lawyer, perhaps a doctor. You're not wealthy. You're doing all right. You love to read, but books are extremely expensive, and there are no libraries. They simply do not exist. They hardly exist anywhere in the United States. A couple of early foundation colleges are beginning to gather books, but that hadn't happened in Philadelphia yet. Penn, which claims to have been founded in 1740, though it was actually 1751, was still on the horizon. So Franklin had an idea. He always had an idea. And his idea went as follows. Look, if a number of us, let's say 100, middling people with a few pounds at that point to spare, were to pool our resources, we could create a book fund. Then we could each write out lists of the books we'd like to see in our collection, cancel the duplicates, and begin to buy in books. Voila, we will have a library. A membership library. Because the gadget was, of course, that only the people that had put the money in and bought a share, as they are still called in membership libraries, including our own, would be entitled to borrow the books. But for its time, it was a brilliant idea. It was brilliant enough that it went viral up and down the east coast of what were then the colonies and would become the east coast of the early republic. And it is estimated, though nobody knows for sure, that by 100 years later, let's say the early to mid 19th century, there may have been 100 of these of one size or shape or another, including this one, which I'll come back to, of course, reaching from Portsmouth, New Hampshire, as far south as Charleston, South Carolina, with all the cities in between, and as far west as Pittsburgh, and then Cincinnati. It was a terrific idea. Our grand and venerable Athenaeum was founded in 1814, but it did not move into this building, the one we are now in, until 1847. For a whole long generation, the Athenaeum met in rented quarters, primarily, although I don't think exclusively, the first floor of the Philosophical Hall, just about two blocks away. By 1845, the members had put together enough money to hire this young architect, John Notman, to design the building we're in today, and it opened in 1847. Notman would go on to have a pretty distinguished career here in Philadelphia and elsewhere. You are familiar with some of his buildings, even if you didn't know it. Holy Trinity Church on Rittenhouse Square is one of his, and St. Clement's up on 20th Street near the Free Library is another of his, and the portal to Laurel Hill Cemetery is one of his. So here we are. As of 1847, having been founded over 200 years ago, the Athenaeum in its extraordinary and important, architecturally important quarters. This is called an Italianate Revival building, and it had a tremendous influence on subsequent architecture. It was not the first brownstone Italian building in the country, but it was the first on this scale and the first that attracted a lot of attention. Whether you can see them clearly or not, what I want to do is spend a sentence or two on just a few of the earliest and founding members of the Athenaeum. And I'm going to go from bottom to top, and I'm not going to pause over all of them. Nicholas Biddle, at the bottom, one of the founding members. You will recall that Nicholas Biddle was president of the Second Bank and went to war with Andrew Jackson over the renewal of the charter. And of course, Biddle lost. And in 1837, America entered one of the worst depressions in its history. Two up from that, Peter de Ponceau, remarkable character. When Bob Hauser was here a week or two back to talk about the APS, American Philosophical Society, he mentioned de Ponceau and his contributions to Native American language acquisition and scholarship and so on. De Ponceau also, as Bob mentioned, made a name for himself in Chinese linguistics. I was curious about that, having spent a little time in that country. So I got in touch with a man named Victor Mayer, who is widely regarded as the most important scholar of Chinese language, probably working anywhere, but certainly in the United States. And Victor wrote back immediately, "Peter, you have struck gold." Peter de Ponceau was two centuries ahead of his time in his understanding of the way Chinese writing really works. His book on Chinese language, published by the American Philosophical Society in 1838, has insights that many linguists today are still incapable of grasping. Second from the top is Robert Vaux. I'll come back to him in another connection a little later. But with William Tilghman at the top, share number one, the founder, the first president of the Athenaeum, who was at that time Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, you will indulge me in a personal digression. So several years ago, I published a history of adoption. And in preparation for that book, I read widely in the history of children, the status of children, the treatment of children, the fate of children across centuries. And what I discovered, I wasn't exactly astounded by this, but what I found confirmed is that for most of recorded history, and I mean recorded back to the Code of Hammurabi, 1750 or so BCE, which has four clauses on adoption in it, that throughout all of recorded history, children were either actually legally or customarily regarded as the property of their parents, and more specifically, the property of their father. In ancient Rome, for example, fathers literally and legally had the right of life and death over their newborn children. All this began to change in the 18th century. It's an entangled and controversial word nowadays, but the Enlightenment brought with it what some scholars have called a humanitarian revolution, when the idea of personhood was being extended. This is the time when, recall, the abolition movement is gaining strength and momentum. This is a time when, for example, in the publication in 1790, something or other by Mary Wollstonecraft, Vindication of the Rights of Woman, women's rights are beginning to at least be added to the agenda of expanding equality and progressive recognition of other people's personhood. The third part of this story, which is not as familiar as the first two, is something similar was happening for children. So fast forward to 2019, indeed actually to the latter part of the 20th century, and all of the 50 states in the United States and the UN Charter on the Rights of Children include as a governing principle in discussing the disposition of children, whether in custody disputes or adoption, the best interest of the child. Now, that's not a panacea for children because, after all, everybody on both sides of the dispute will claim to be working in the best interest of the child, and it's not self-defining, but what it did do was dramatically shift the focus of attention and say the priority here is not dad, much less mom, it's the child. In 1813, in a case that he decided in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, William Tilghman invented the concept of the best interest of the child. In an extraordinary ruling in which, actually to the shock of almost everybody who read about it, he denied a father's claims in a custody dispute to the repossession of a child who had been taken by the mother and said, our sole anxiety must be for the welfare of the child. And that ruling has rolled down now for over two centuries and made a difference here and around the world. So William Tilghman and I, shareholder number one, and I'm shareholder about 1936 or something, have a bond. In the middle of the 19th century, something else began to happen. Another idea began to emerge subsequent to Franklin's very good idea in 1731. And that was the free library movement, the free public tax-supported library movement. The photograph on the screen shows Peterborough, New Hampshire Town Library, considered to be, as the caption tells you, the first tax-funded public library in the United States. It's about 1830, 1831, 32. I personalized this theme with Andrew Carnegie. Franklin stands for the membership library, a brilliant idea in its day. Carnegie has the right, though he didn't invent the idea, to be associated with the free library movement. One afternoon, I don't know on what date, sometime in the 1860s or 70s, he stood on the porch of one of his several houses and pulled out a piece of paper and said, here's what I think I'll do. I will pay half the costs of up to 2,000 free public libraries if cities around the country, and by the way, a couple overseas, will pay the other half. And it actually happened. 1,900 plus of these libraries were built all over the United States. Here in Philadelphia, you will still find them. They are now all of them chapters of or branches of the big free library system. But in a few cases, for example, 40th and Walnut, over the lintel, when you walk into this 40th and Walnut branch of the free library, is the name Carnegie. This is a photograph of our Philadelphia Free Library's central building. Some of you were here when Siobhan Reardon, the president of this remarkable institution, came and talked about the way in which libraries have had to evolve. I regard the free library system, that movement, going back into the middle of the 19th century, as the most underappreciated step forward for democracy in American history. Everybody could go into a library. You didn't have to be a member. You didn't have to have money. You could borrow the books. You could borrow the magazines. You could sit simply and read quietly. And as Siobhan pointed out, and as we, I think, all know who have been reading the newspapers, libraries today, free libraries, public libraries, have had to evolve some more. They are now places in which people without access to the internet can get it. People who need a little help with their CVs can get it. Children after school can find refuge. And sadly, library staff in some branches have, of course, been trained to give injections that keep people from dying of opioids. It's a remarkable history. But then so is the Athenaeums. And we, too, have evolved over the last couple of centuries. And now let's get into that. So we find ourselves today in a membership library, which continues to be a membership circulating library. Lots of our members, including many in this room, like to come here, like to borrow the books, like to sit in the reading room, and we're glad for that. But we have also become a major architectural archive. Over the last half century or so, the collection now probably exceeds, I am told, about 360,000 drawings. What I'm showing you may be the most iconic or the most well-known. This is Thomas Eustick Walter's 1855 design for the Capitol Dome in Washington. That sits safely in a locked case in our locked air-conditioned vault. And I am told that every once in a while, the Library of Congress calls our board president and says, wouldn't that be better down here? And he says, no, we think it's fine right here. This is another of Thomas Eustick Walter's Capitol Dome drawings. And if you could see it close up, which you can't quite, in some ways, it's even more remarkable than the large rendering that I just showed you. This is the hand-drawn, hand-inked cross-section of the dome for purposes of construction, with measurements down to the eighth of an inch. These original documents, along with hundreds of other items in the Walter collection, are now at the Athenaeum. Paul Philippe Cray, a good deal of his work is here at the Athenaeum, including the Folger Library, which I'm showing you here. Some of you will recall that not long ago, Dr. Michael Whitmore, the director of the Folger Library, came here to talk about the Folger and about its plans for the future. Here's an interior of the Folger, at least as it was, and as I say, these are materials, many of which are in our collection. But it isn't just collecting that we do. I need to show you something that I wish more of you were familiar with than I think are. This is a rack card, as they're called. You'll find them on the table at the entrance. They've been there for a long time. Philadelphia Architects and Builders. Philadelphia Architects and Builders, I've got a little card here. I've got this card here, is an online resource. Over 265,000 structures in the United States online. Details about architects and builders, building dates, etc. Digital versions of most existing pre-1900 architectural documents of Philadelphia area buildings. The biographies of and references to more than 26,000 architects, builders, contractors, and others. It's an astounding online resource. And that was verified earlier this spring. You can't see this very well. You can see the image on top, but I'm going to take the liberty of actually reading this. The importance of this collection, and equally important, the significance of that PAB website, which makes these materials easily publicly accessible, was acknowledged when the Athenaeum was awarded the Sir, it's a long title, the Sir John Soane's Museum Foundation honors for 2019. It's a more than fairly significant award. The foundation saluted, quote, the visionary leadership of the Athenaeum, your acquisition of significant collections, and your transformation from an early 19th century library into a vibrant institution that has become an integral part of the cultural fabric of 21st century Philadelphia and beyond. Your investment in preservation, expansion, and accessibility of resources has made the Athenaeum a vital resource for our profession. Previous winners of this award include the Museum of Modern Art, Yale University's British Art Center, and the Carnegie Museum Hall of Architecture in Pittsburgh. We're very proud of that. We're very proud of that because it demonstrates that while we have remained what we were and will continue to remain what we were, a membership library serving the reading needs and interests of our members, we have become more. We've also become a small museum. We have about 75 paintings in our collection, most of them American. I'm just going to give you two or three to look at. All of them, by the way, are online. You can go find that online as well. This is by the wonderful local painter, Violet Oakley, one of our long-term board members back in the earlier 20th century. Charles Wharton Stalk, Violet Oakley's picture of him. This is by Marie Danforth Page, a painting of Anne Hawkes Vaux. You'll find her at the base of the Grand Staircase. When I got here a little over 3 years ago, I asked if there were things in storage that I might like to see, and I was brought this painting covered in soot and framed in a shabby little brown wooden falling apart frame. I took one look and said, we've got to have her on the wall. In a building like this, meaning not to be too snarky or glib about it, most of the portraits are dead white guys in suits who don't smile at you. Here is a vivacious young woman, not only smiling, but possessed of a tennis racket, and she now has pride of place down on the first floor. And we also have, aside from portraits, some landscape paintings. This one could be of interest to you. This is 1840, the Fairmount Waterworks. And so what you're looking at on that flat top is once a reservoir, eventually carved out, and today the Grand Philadelphia Museum of Art is on that space. We also have something like 300,000 photographs in our collection. A lot of them, if not most of them, architectural, landscape architecture, and so on. Here's simply one, Lawrence Williams, Market Street, looking through the City Hall Porter East, 1950. It's astoundingly evocative. And we have tens and indeed hundreds of thousands of those photographs. We have thousands of maps. We are a cartographic center for researchers and others, people simply looking for tell me about my house in 1875, if it existed at that point. We also have a wonderful stained glass collection, not the glass, but the wonderful watercolors that are always drawn in anticipation of the glass from a studio of a man called Niccolo D'Accenzo in the first third of the 20th century. And what you're seeing here, and you can see a little bit of it from where you are, is the allegory of justice. The female figure who is looking down on the aggrieved or weeping or at least anxious parents. And that big stained glass window is in what used to be Family Court, which is the big building next to the Free Library. As it undergoes renovation, probably into a discotheque or a condominium, that window will stay where it is. It is protected by about 13 covenants and is not going anywhere. We also have objects of different sorts, some of them quite peculiar, some of them fascinating. We have the telescope that Meriwether Lewis carried during the Lewis and Clark expedition. And you can't touch it. I can't touch it. Nobody can touch it. But we have it. We have it safely packed away. Not long ago, I learned that we have a pair of William Wordsworth spectacles. Who knew? You might ask, who cares? I care. I care because I've recently written about the Wordsworth mania that went through the United States in the first half of the 19th century, and this is a function of that. A big fan of Wordsworth here at the Athenaeum in the 1840s who wanted those spectacles and paid somebody to go and ask Wordsworth on bended knee for a pair of his spectacles. This is remarkable. This is part of our Joseph Bonaparte collection, but it's a Napoleon artifact. This is one of the two escutcheons that Napoleon Bonaparte had attached to the two doors of the carriage that took him to Notre Dame in December 1804, where he crowned himself Emperor of the French. It's not gold, but it's gilded, and it's authentic. Take this on Antiques Roadshow, and all the fuses in the building would blow. We do exhibitions, as most of you know. It's what you first see when you come into the building. We do them on a 3 or 4 times a year basis. They almost always involve material from our own collection, photographs, drawings, books from time to time, and book covers, of which we have a remarkable collection, and architecture. I'm showing you just two, the first of which is, a couple of summers ago, Views of Independence, the long history and often very complicated and controversial history of the developing area around Independence Hall, what best to do with that. This one, Real Philadelphia, was more recent and was based upon an extraordinary collection of what are called real postcards that we were given, postcards that actually document this and that ordinary city street in Philadelphia. Photographs of city streets turned into postcards. They're not only evocative of turn of the 20th century Philadelphia, they are in some cases the only photographic image of a given street that exists. So both for scholars and for ordinary citizens looking to track down as much as they can of their own houses, we are the place. We of course do lots of programming. Some of that programming is architectural. And as some of you who were here will recall, last annual meeting a couple of months ago, we invited Martin Filler to come and talk about his latest book in the series, The Makers of Modern Architecture. And we do lots of book talks. Last fall, several of us, a couple of pals of mine and I got together and we did lectures on Kafka's stories, Emily Dickinson's poetry, and The Souls of Black Folk by W.E.B. Du Bois. And most recently, many of you were here for this, contemporary writers as well, obviously, Madeline Miller's wonderful Circe. We give a book prize. I hope most of you know that. If you don't, you do now. Since 1950, the Athenaeum has been giving an award to a Philadelphia-based writer for a book of fiction, usually not fiction, but it can be either. And that bookcase, which I am now pointing at, on the north side of this room, contains in chronological order all the books that have won the prize in the 69 years since the prize was first offered. We also have done lectures on painting. Professor Wendy Steiner came and asked us, what is it we see when we look at a nude? And she gave some provocative and smart answers. We've done a film series with Carrie Rickey, that terrific critic for The Inquirer. Philadelphia films, including Philadelphia Story, were this season's films. Next season, she'll be back. We do music. We happen to be lucky in Philadelphia because Tempesta di Mare, which is probably regarded as the finest Baroque orchestra in the country, happens to be headquartered in Philadelphia, as is Pifaro, the Renaissance band who came here and made a joyful noise, as is also the Al Bustan Ensemble, some spectacular Arab musicians who came and blew the roof off this place about a year and a half ago. We do a little bit of theater. We've on a couple of occasions invited actors to come and do Shakespeare. You can't read the text, it doesn't matter. I just wanted to see Shakespeare. Young actors from the Philadelphia Artists Collective came and did a kind of master class for our members back in December of 2016. But along with the book talks and the movie talks and the painting talks and the architecture talks, we also seek to engage our members and the Athenaeum in discussions around events that might be called contemporary, and sometimes controversial, and a few examples of those. Patrick Harker, the president of the Philadelphia Federal Reserve, came to talk about the mysterious workings of the Fed, but also to talk about the prospects for the regional economy, our regional economy. Dr. William Height, the superintendent of Philadelphia Public Schools, came to talk about the achievements and the challenges of leading one of the largest school districts in the country against the enormous long odds that are the consequence, of course, of almost complete indifference on the part of politicians for the education of urban children. I said once earlier that Roberts Vaux, shareholder number 3, would come back into this talk eventually. Roberts Vaux, back in the 19th century, was the first president of the Philadelphia School Board. And so when I invited Dr. Height to come and talk, I said, we will be celebrating not only the work you've been trying to do here so successfully, but the Athenaeum's engagement in that work over a century ago. We did a panel on immigration in Philadelphia, providing for our members a panel of scholars from Rutgers and Penn, both information and the contributions that immigrants have made to our community. Eastern State Penitentiary, 1829, it's important on its own terms as an architectural monument, the first Jeremy Bentham-style panopticon. Everybody who was committed to Eastern State was put into solitary confinement so that they could become penitent while they thought about their sins. That's why it was not called a prison or a jail. It was called a penitentiary. It took about a day and a half for people to start to go mad inside those solitary cells. So eventually, that was abandoned. Architecturally significant building began to go into disrepair and disarray in the latter part of the 20th century. And finally, it came close to being torn down or repurposed as a supermarket or something. But finally, a decision was made, let us try and save this building because it's important. So beginning in the 90s, that has happened, and it's still an ongoing project. However, if you've been to Eastern State in the last decade, what you know is that Eastern State has now adopted a secondary mission. Along with historic preservation, Eastern State has become a nationally significant headquarters in the protest against mass incarceration. And so when I invited the brilliant young vice president to come here, Sean Kelly, whom I, by the way, have known since he was a child because one of my children and he were classmates many, many years ago, when I invited Sean Kelly to come, I said, Sean, I don't want Eastern State as an architectural monument. I want a talk called Architecture and Justice, and he gave a brilliant talk. History professor Stephen Kahn, came this spring to talk about resistance in the age, Thoreau in the Age of Resistance, and that's Thoreau's picture, not Stephen's, on the postcard. Stephen wanted his picture, but I insisted that it be Thoreau. In any case, gave a talk in which he placed our current anxieties in the context of Thoreau's civil disobedience, that universally acclaimed founding document in the history, at least in the Western world, and indeed around the world, of disobedience. Those are some of the programs. You just received this as a bulletin yesterday, I think, or even today, but I'm repeating it here. We now have put most of our talks on podcasts. There are about 30 or 33 of them already there, and there will be more, I'm sure, in the future. And so if you attended one that you liked and want to revisit, or there was one that you missed and you wish you had gone, it is now possible at least to get the audio cast, and that's all we do by and large. We do a couple with slides, but slides can get you into copyright trouble and so on. So we at least post the podcasts for our talks. One of our other activities is to collaborate with other institutions when we can. The most probably significant example occurred last year. Many of you may recall this. To go back to Paul Cray, we own much of the Cray material, and the Philadelphia Museum of Art owns the Rodin Museum. So Mr. Timothy Rubb and I got together and said, let us collaborate on a weekend of Paul Cray and modern classicism. The keynote address was given here on Friday night, May 11th last year, by Paul Goldberger, Timothy Rubb introducing, and the panels were given up at PMA all day Saturday with me introducing, and a good time was had by all. We also last fall opened an online shop. Now, I want to be frank with you. Nobody makes any money on an online shop. I've consulted with a couple of directors of and marketing people for significant places, including PMA and others. That's not why you do it. I mean, you hope to make a few dollars. Here's why you do it. The Athenaeum, like every museum, large and small, every library, large and small, and especially every archive, large and small, is unable to put on display for your edification most of the treasures that it owns. And so we do our best, in one way or another, to try and at least, A, as I have been trying to do, make you proud of what we have, even if you don't see most of it, because it is to die for. But B, if you go to our online shop, you can browse through what are now about 250 images of the stuff that is not very often, if ever, going to be on the walls or be in a vitrine. And so the analytics tell us that although we're not selling much, people are browsing like mad. And that's all we want. We really want you to come and get a chance to see more of what we have to offer. And what you, in a certain sense, have to offer, because none of this would have happened without 200 years of support from members and their generosity. Final slide, and coming back to our core mission, our founding mission. Circulating library, membership library. This again, you can't read, but you're familiar with it, I hope, and if you're not, I intend to read it. Shareholders, that's many of you in this room, not all, but you could change that if you're not. Shareholders now use Penn's Franklin catalog, which contains the records of the more than 7 million volumes in Penn's circulating collections. Our shareholders now have borrowing access to those books as well as the Athenaeum's holdings. Books that are housed at the Athenaeum will be identified as such. Books that the Athenaeum does not own or that are checked out when the shareholder conducts the search can now request through Franklin. All Athenaeum shareholders will be offered courtesy borrowing privileges at Penn without charge. Penn will waive the usual fee of $400 a year for our members, a waiver that will be renewed annually. If a shareholder chooses to check out a book from Penn, the Penn Library will deliver the volume to the Athenaeum without charge. Books can also be returned to Penn via our library without charge. It's a remarkable, in my view at least, opportunity, not necessarily for everyone, but for those who choose to have access not only to this library with full borrowing privileges for your share, but to one of the most comprehensive and impressive libraries between Princeton and Johns Hopkins. Final slide. I want to thank all of you for coming today, and perhaps more importantly, for supporting the Athenaeum, as most of you have. Some of you I see in the room for decades, others merely for years, and a few just for a couple of months. It has been a privilege and a pleasure to be part of this administration for the last 3.5 years. And I think with that, I'm going to say with some trepidation, I am prepared to take some questions or comments. Thank you very much. Thank you. Remember, think carefully about questions, because there is a grand reception waiting in the room next door. So all questions will be standing between us and that reception. But that's okay. It's on you. Go ahead.
What are you
going to
do next?
Part of what I'm going to do next is spend a little more time with my wife and 7 grandchildren who are in various parts of the east part of the United States. Terry and I do quite a lot of traveling. We're going to do more. And I have some work to do in the Penn Library. Penn was kind enough when I retired to let me continue to occupy a small office because they knew I might return. They said they were letting me have this office for 2 reasons. 1, to recognize my long and distinguished service, and 2, because they didn't need the space. And they made it clear that as soon as they needed the space, my long and distinguished service would be erased. But so far, so good. The question is, if I understood it correctly, had to do with enlarging the opportunities to bring as many people as possible into this variety of libraries that we have. Librarians will sort libraries into just a few bins, actually. Academic libraries, university and college libraries. School libraries, which tragically in this city, by the way, as you may know, are disappearing from schools. Private libraries or membership libraries of this sort, of which there are quite a few that remain. And then a miscellaneous category called special, a law library, a medical library, a corporate library, etc. I think Philadelphia, and I can't compare it with any other place, because I know the little I know about Philadelphia is much more than I know about any other city. But I think the free library is more than discharging its obligations to be a resource for as many of the citizens of this city, both those who walk in, as many people in this room, including myself, might, and want to do a conventional day's work in a library of some significance. The free library can offer that. But also, as I was mentioning, and as many of you know, under Siobhan's leadership and under the pressure of what's going on in what is, you will recall, the poorest of the 10 largest cities in the United States, access to those who ordinarily wouldn't be going into a library for the sorts of purposes that you and I might bring to a library. What we've tried to do is to collaborate as much as we can. We invested some time and effort, and I believe it will continue in figuring out ways to collaborate with the Charter High School of Art and Design, which is just a block and a half from here, and which at some level is a perfect fit for collaboration, and we've accomplished a little bit in that direction. I do think we're probably lucky in this city in the variety of libraries and library-like institutions that we have. Can you imagine? You walk out of this building, and depending on which direction you turn, you're at the American Philosophical Society. You're at the Library Company. You're at the Historical Society of Pennsylvania. Last week, we did we helped the Horticultural Society, the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society, celebrate its 190th birthday. I said the 215-year-old Athenaeum was pleased to host the merely 190-year-old Pennsylvania Horticultural Society with their rare collections and so on, together with all the branches of the Free Library and the Free Library itself, which now, by the way, also is the, I don't want to use the word owner, but the wonderful Rosenbach is now part of that system as well. So I can't comment, you know, dogmatically on what exactly should next be done. I can say that I think steps have been taken. I can say that we're reasonably pleased with some of the stuff we've tried here. I'm very proud of what Siobhan has been doing over at the Free Library, and that the resources we have in this city, and perhaps especially in this part of the city, but throughout, are just extraordinary. It's a pleasure and a privilege for anybody who likes to read to be here. Eduardo. Yes. Eduardo Glant, the distinguished former dean of the Engineering School at the University of Pennsylvania, has, not for the first time, suggested to me that libraries are becoming museums and books merely artifacts. One answer I could give you is, Eduardo, it's like jazz. If I have to explain it, you'll never know. But, I mean, the indications are that books have a future, and libraries have a future. They certainly do not figure in the professional plans of many scientists, both wet bench scientists and hard scientists. They certainly, you know, in an academic universe, which is where I live most of my life, there are lots of disciplines whose members never set foot inside a conventional library. It's all online, it's all articles, and I respect that. It's just a different style of doing things. It could be that we may be romanticizing the extent to which libraries were ever comprehensive in their membership. That is to say, there probably was no golden age in which everybody and his brother and sister was coming into the library to do their reading. It's always been, in an odd way, although on a vast and sometimes very healthy scale, a kind of boutique operation. You know, lots of people don't spend much time in libraries and never have. But I do think there is a role for us to play in that part of a library's mission, which consists in preserving and conserving and making accessible our heritage. To go back to Goethe, libraries are the memories of mankind. I also don't trust things that are stored in the cloud. I have a hunch that that metaphor is going to betray us someday. But, you know, I'm a layman, maybe even a Luddite. One more. Who would like to do? Yeah, go ahead. That's such a lovely question. With it, the question was about, is whimsy part of our collecting policy? I don't mean to put it, but that's essentially what it was. Because you look at, you know, an object like the Lewis and Clark telescope or the spectacles that Wordsworth once wore. No, whimsy is not. I have to give you a fairly sober answer. We have about a 15-page, I think, single-space collections management policy online, and that governs what we do. So I think if whimsy enters our collection, it enters at a right angle and probably at 8 o'clock at night when everybody else is going home. Thank you very much. Let's go have a reception.